come here. Get off.
Today, we are talking to Dr. Lanice Avery, pronouns she and her. Lanice is an assistant professor of psychology and women, gender, and sexuality studies at the University of Virginia. She earned her PhD in the joint program in psychology and women's studies at the University of Michigan. Yes, Midwest. Her research uses multiple methods to explore Black women's intersectional identities, sexual socialization, and how the negotiation of hegemonic gender ideologies and racial stereotypes are associated with adverse psychological and sexual health outcomes. The primary aim of her research is to promote healthy racial, gender, and sexual development among socially marginalized and stigmatized groups. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so
that's just a really fancy way of saying she's a bad
dope
bitch.
As hell. Right.
She's a bad bitch. She knows her shit. She is fighting to make all Black women bad bitches as well.
Yes.
Indeed. Family of bad bitches. Like,
exactly that. So, you know, I interviewed Lanice for my next book, and we didn't even get that far into the interview before I was like, oh, bitch, you got to come on the show. I didn't know what book it was going to be.
Let's do that right now. Let's do that.
I was like, but we going to make that happen. So thank you.
I'm really glad to be here. Really glad. Yay. I feel like I do all of my psychology work to finally get invited to have the conversations that I want to have, which is much more in this format.
Yay. Yay. Hey, we'll take it.
We're about to jump on in. So what did little Dr. Lanice want to be when she grew up? I'm sorry, I'm going to call you doctor all day because
you earned it.
So yes, what did little Dr. Lanice want to be when she was growing up?
Little Dr. Lanice wanted to be in Vogue. I feel like giving him something he can feel came out and I was like, I want that career. I didn't want to give him something he could feel, but I wanted to be with that crew. Like, I felt always very enthused about femininity. I felt like Black women were just magic and that their partners were whack and I could be better partners for them from early. Like, I remember watching Felicia Rashad and I was like, your husband's whack. Like, you're the baddest of them all. He's corny as fuck. Like, if all you got to do is be a doctor to get you a Claire Huxtable, I'll be that. Like, I'll do that because I bet you I can turn it out in the way that she deserves, because he's not cutting it. I know he isn't. And so I feel like very similarly, I would always be kind of watching the baddest women, like on all fronts, and then squelching themselves, shrinking themselves, succumbing to this violence, succumbing to these like circumstances. And I'm like, girl, why? And also like, I know it's not like that. I can't even imagine the level of like audacity that we have in the world to save all of us, the responsibility for racial uplift, the like phenomenal baddie that we must be, to often be in these configurations that are like not well suited for our magic. I just could not understand. I feel like I was a baby like early in, and I was like, well, I don't really get the heterosexual like commitment. But I will try to figure out with y'all, if y'all gonna be over there, how to improve the stories that you all are incurring of the hardship in your life just via your like gendered social expectation to save us. Like, Black women are always going to save us. They're saving my people, save themselves and each other over and over and over again. And I'm like, well, who's coming for us? It's just us. And then what are we willing to risk and gamble in the event that we would get some love or for the D? And I never really understood that, but I really wanted to think through that. So first I wanted to be in Vogue first and foremost. And I realized, oh, that's a group and that's not always forever. And then they're, you know, battling it out and they won't actually be your lovers. They'll just be your colleagues and they hate each other. And I was like, all right, I guess I'll put up my health and try to be a doctor so that I can get a Claire Huxtable and also to be kind of responsible to get folks in an office and say, like, girl, there's a whole lot of things going on. And also, like, you got 99 problems and your nigga's like the main one. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about that. And then so through working in the hospital, I was mostly interested in what was possible in the nurse practitioner area and in working in women's health clinic and who was doing outreach. I felt like those people were smarter. I felt like the folks who came in had more information about what's happening in their worlds than anybody in the hospital ever did. And so I think being a curious bitch, infinitely asking questions sort of led me to this like community health venture where I work whoever got the most dollars to make the most sense. And that currently looks like being a professor at the University of Virginia, but I don't feel that I ever was like, I want to be a professor. I just want to like pontificate. I just want to know, why are we making these terrible fucking choices and who is coming for us? And until then, I will save them and you can lay in my bosom while you like soothe your pains from what the world is doing to us and mastermind how we're going to once again save ourselves.
Okay. Wow. Well, that's it. And now you see why we brought Dr. Lanice on because just back up real quick. Did you say heterosexual or ghetto-sexual?
That's what I thought of her.
Yes, such a term.
It is ghetto as hell. When I like as a and I'm a gold star, Ben Dykin since Ben Dykin. That's all I know. But I have these, you know, homegirls, and I'll be like, well, what are y'all doing? Like, what are y'all talking about? Like, what is courtship? Like, what's the pop off? Like, I just don't understand the pacing. And I understand it also looks like wild because it's like, we talked for 3 weeks and we're soulmates and now we live together. You know, like, I understand. And I'm not saying that queer relationships are inherently so different too, because a lot of people do like internalize this like raggedy configuration that's about like, he got to be the king, even though he's not. Like, your role is to make him feel in somewhere in the world that he has eminent domain, even when he doesn't. And then just like make sure that he doesn't burn every fucking thing down in the like moment that you're trying to bolster that. And I'm like, but if he don't know, why would you do that? Like if you don't trust him to do that and it's you in the end, like, why wouldn't y'all just state that up front? So I do think some of the logics of heterosexuality feel ghetto to me. You know, that's not Earth is Ghetto, I want to leave. I'm like, girl, like, why? Like, as a sexologist studying like pleasure, orgasm, and desire, and I'm like, and you're not even getting off at the end of it. Like, why are we here? It must be. I don't know about it, but I will study the hell out of it, and I will ask a million questions over a lifetime and still not get the answers because we continue to be here. But then also, like, I'm saying that in joke because literally I am jokes, like, it's humor first, but in sincerity. When thinking about what is a woman, what is health? What does women's health and wellness actually look like in a context that has always been designed to kill us? And where every single action has the reaction that causes casualty on us. What does it mean to be well in the system? And what does it mean to be well in community? And what does it mean to be well in home when even your community and the folks who live in your home to sometimes add to like your detriment. And I think being in women's health and trying to think through, I started in an HIV prevention and reproductive health like lane, and coming to these workshops with all of my participants, and I worked in emancipated youth programs, and I work with a lot of drop-in centers, and I work in county jails and juvenile halls. And everyone would say, like, all of this is worth it for love. If that's my dude, if I feel accepted, if he accepts me, if he makes me feel full, I will ride. It seems like not that big of a deal to get HIV if you had the opportunity in some way to experience that like love that I'm calling this like transformative love, this radical like acceptance that gives you room to be outside of the body of shame, outside of the body of constraints. You actually just get to feel full and desired. And I was like, man, you will risk everything, sanity, sense, coins, and actual freedom when we're thinking about it in like a context of confinement, like going to jail, for the experience of love. Well done. seems like that's what my question is. And so I have always committed myself to the study and the practice of love.
Right. So what is, you do a lot, like we just talked about. What's your favorite thing about it?
I have so many favorite things. One thing that is my favorite is how everyone will come to, and no matter the domain that I'm sort of doing this work in, I'll get listed. I think white people come and they're like, let's see what Black failure looks like as a spectacle. Mm. Or people come and they're like, she's attractive and she seems nice, so I want to be there to support her, but never really understanding themselves in life as being primary stakeholders to Black women's freedom and joy and pleasure. They don't imagine that that has anything to do with them. And by the end, watching them have to interrogate what have they done to kind of be complicit in this systemic harm that comes on Black women's bodies. And also, like, they are so thirsty to be down. And I recognize that being down for white folks who are complicit in racism and systemic, like, misogyny noir, it means little to me. I'm like, did you give all your money and all your time to save us? Then what is really being down? Mm-hmm. But I do think watching what I have presumed to be the staunch, like, and committed antagonists of Black womanhood change their attitude and figure, like, oh shit, that's where actual my freedom is too. Mm-hmm. My freedom is in interrogating how am I complicit in the system, and then taking, like, a license, taking a step back to ask me, like, homegirl, can you tell me what to do? I'm like, for a fee, I will boss you around forever. Yes, I will. So I do like that. I like moving this radical enterprise that's literally about getting off and all the way and being free and being able to get some of the highest vestiges of power to invest in that project. That just feels thug to me. And I feel like that is true to my South Central origins. But I also love watching Black women get the opportunity for 1 minute to imagine that there's more. Because I think we get really complicit, comfortable holding the breadcrumbs, like the breadcrumbs as like Thanksgiving, and being like, well, this is everything, right? And it's like, actually, what if that was literally just crumbs and there was like an infinite capacity for you to have more? More desire, more pleasure, more fullness, more joy. Like, and that you can make all of these decisions about that and be full of you and your sisters collectively. And that squad can be literally all the things. What happens if you make a decision forever based on pleasure and fullness rather than gratitude and like concerns and communalism and don't stir the pot shit? And what if, like, instead of being afraid of every negative stereotype that will come at you, what if you said, okay, bitch, I'll be that. Like, just like dudes do. What if you did that and you actually tried it? And watching them try that in small ways and come back in the transformative experience that it is for them in these small and these big ways. I love to be a conduit of more possibility and more joy for Black women. And I love that literally I only think about us, and I get a lot of money and a lot of team and a lot of resources to also build squads that will only and very explicitly and boundariedly think about us and our joy and our possibility.
Okay, so you've given us all the joys of your what you do, and it sounds beautiful, but what's the most challenging part?
The most challenging part is the isolation that comes with what it means to be in the academia and to do the kind of work that I do, where I feel like all of my contemporaries, the people who move me the most, I'm very far from them. It's an endeavor I took because I'm like, where's the money? I want to get all of it and give it all back to us. But it means that I'm having a lot of conversations generally with white folks who don't mean us well to buy them over. Mm-hmm. Even though I do end up winning them over and I am successful and I get to train people with how to do that, is the furthest from the folks that I love. And like gaining, I guess, mastery over the language and the skills, the statistics, the computation, the analysis, all of those things that make me very good at being an academic feminist psychologist. They meant, so prime example, as part of my like community health practice that I had when I was an undergrad and working with activists here in the Bay Area, we did a mediation group. So there were a lot of folks who would experience domestic violence, and we wanted to be able to provide an alternative to calling the police. So you would call the mediation team, and we would go in, and me and my crew sort of specialize in working with queer folks and maybe folks who might be mask of center or gender non-conforming, because they fare worse sometimes in these interfaces with the police. But in the way that we would sort of go and do health promotion and do mediation work with those couples, it was so energizing, it was so enlivening. But I went to grad school, and I would come back and I would think about these elements, and it would be the language that I had to, that I now had exposure to, and the like frameworks that I was using, I became less and less approachable to the community, less and less effective with those interpersonal mediation, right? Like the further that I got into academia, the less I was like in the practical. And the moment that my colleagues had to say, like, this isn't working anymore, we need to move you into a different space, you move into lecture quickly, you move into like data would say very quickly, because that's convincing to you. And also that's not generally how people move. They feel, can easily feel judged, feel read, and also not feel compelled to have action items for change because you're like so data driven in your approach. That hurt. It was the right thing to do, to recognize that it can be that I'm growing beyond the ways that I had understood like my mission, and to grow to embody even a vaster mission, maybe, but not vaster comparatively, saying that I diminished that work. But every moment that buying into something else takes me sort of out and away from the people that I love and the lives that I care about the most, that is one of the largest challenges. Not only did I have to move from the Bay, the yay, if you will, to move to like Michigan, which I loved Michigan, but I'm not from the Detroit. And Detroit would be like, if you're from Ann Arbor, we ain't rocking with you. You're a colonist here. You're over here to take from us and go write about it or whatever and dip. And we have a boundary around that. And that was true. And then I thought I was going to come home, but then I got this remarkable opportunity to do transdisciplinary scholarship with Bankroll Thomas Jefferson on some like, you know, salvation for Sally Hemings moment. But I was over there in this really new and interesting context that had a lot of opportunities, but there's two Black women at the time that worked in my department. And so being a good steward of those opportunities is important, but it's hard when you just like can't find a boo to grease your scalp and cook you some food, rub on your booty, and like, you know, help you test, you know, let me run my shit. Like, let me know if I'm good, if it's popping, you hitting it, you feeling it. You know, you're removed from those connections. And it means that I sort of had all of these separate selves. I'm always going to be my full self because, like, girl, it's a lot and it's too much to try to do anything else. But like being in community with folks who are doing that too, who are moving you, who are energizing you, is like increasingly harder the further that I ascend in the
So it's interesting. We always ask folks like what was the prevailing attitude about sex in their you know, houses growing up. But I want to expand that. I want to ask, what were you getting in the house as little Dr. Lanice that helped you to be able to, like, what were the prevailing attitudes around, you know, identity and around sex and around race that like helped to contribute to you being this person who you are right now, or didn't?
I was an only child my mom had six siblings. Everybody had like five kids. And I was the only me, and my mom, again, growing up in South Central in the 80s, it was the height of crack epidemic, lots of men leaving all the time. Also, I'm Mexican and Black. So on the Mexican side, you've got immigration issues and ICE. And every day there's this like, you have to say goodbye to your men and you may never see them again, right? You don't know. And in that way, it felt like men always had room. They didn't have to do anything because, like, they're chronically endangered. It was so great to finally find Joan Morgan when Chicken had come home to roost, has this, like, framework or this chapter that talks about the endangered Black men and the strong Black woman, because that was the domain, that was the dynamic. Women are so assertive and you need to call that to nourish and nurture and praise these kings who are under fire, who are targeted and hunted. But what that meant is that sometimes they didn't feel like they had any socialization to be connected to any kind of opportunities or any sort of responsibilities. Because, like, every day that I make it home, the miracle has happened. So, like, drops to your knees, bust it down low, cook my food, and, like, we all can just be grateful. And it's women's then responsibility for everything: kids, family, parents, community, housing, home. Every single element fell to the shoulders of women. But women were so tight in my world making, like, the way that I saw that, the way that my mom's best friends, sister, cousin, baby cousins, like, from over there would show up to do the work that none of these absent fathers were doing. The way that if the money was tight, they would come together to do a catering event, to do somebody something in order to get that money so that you got yourself, so your baby got school clothes or they get to go to their thing. Like, the way that women, like, showed up and out for each other, Black women specifically, I was really moved by, energized by, and was like, if I was going to partner with anybody, like, obviously it would be that, because I will never be out here. My boo will go the hardest and I will consistently go the hardest for her. And there's a degree of reciprocity that we always have in Black sisterhood that I don't ever see is actually matched. But I do think that part of my family being, like, a lot of the women are very fair skinned, again, having this, you know, bicultural, like, contingency, there was, like, such a sexualization for, like, thug ass niggas. Like, whoever that is, whoever just got out, whoever's buck, they're like, I'm about to tear that up. It will tear me up and down. And it will probably last for about 10 to 12 months before they, like, return to wherever they came from to get that buck in the first place. But what a ride and what a story to tell. So I do think that as an ear hustling ass curious kid, I was always trying to figure out, what are these grown bitches talking about? The, like, stay out of grown folks' business was for me. I was so precocious. I could chill for a little bit. But I just loved watching these women finally get into the space and let themselves talk about what this D is doing for them, what he did, how that happened. Girl, he had me. And I was like, the joy of, like, Black women having to be muted because we're so angry, because it's so fucked up. Everything that we're moving through every day is so intense. There's so much pain. But the moment that you get to either talk shit, women love to do that and come together to talk shit, but talking shit specifically about how you got turned out and what you let yourself do, what you let yourself experience, that good Kiki was, like, my favorite. So I learned that niggas ain't shit, but it is a very good time and it will elicit, like, a remarkable amount of joy, mostly with your homegirls, when you get the opportunity to tell the stories about beauty that you experience. Also, the pain that you experience with your dudes kind of bring you closer to your sisters anyway. But it always came back to your sisters, which is why I was like, let's just chop out the middle name. Not even before. I feel like if we all over here, let's just be over here.
You just talking about, like, coming back with your girls, the kiki among the sisters, like, that is, I feel like when I get together with my girls, that is pretty much what it's about, you know? The joy and beauty of sisterhood. And I think it's amazing that at a young age, you were able to see it and hone in on it and really study it. Because I think personally, as an adult, I am not one of those, I don't have female friends kind of chicks.
Perplexing. That's such a red flag. Like,
yeah.
What happened to you, boo? Like, that's wild.
Yeah.
You're like, so I'm going to be the first to die is basically
exactly
what I'm saying.
Yeah. All right. But as of late, not too late, but, you know, recently I started to, like, really soak up and enjoy. I mean, like, I've always enjoyed my relationships with my girlfriends, but I'm now like seeing the beauty in it and the joy in that. And it's very important for my girlfriends. I mean, I have a son, but my son sees it. I want him to see the value in it. I want all the young all my nieces to see the value in girlfriends. It was interesting. I was out of town last week, and my girlfriend's daughter was with us, and we were like, she was running errands, and she dropped her daughter off, and she got dressed, and her daughter was like, "Where are you going?" She was like, "I'm going to see my girlfriends." "Why are you getting dressed up?" She was like, "You always get dressed up to go see your girls."
Shout out to all my hosts. Like, shout out to all my girls who know we show up, we show out for each other.
Because, I mean, on a date, you're going to get some comfy, some flats. But for my girls, bitch, look at these heels. Yeah.
Yes. And also, because they're the ones who are going to say that. You might get a compliment or something, but sometimes, like, folks who ain't in don't even know what they're looking at. They're like, something happened. Mm-hmm. I see the energy, I'm feeling that, but I don't know, and I can't tell enough to really appreciate what did you do, like, and how much time did all of that take? Like, I see, like, see it, yes. Eat it,
yeah.
You know? And if you don't have a refined palette, then you're, for what?
What's the point? It looks good. No, this is a new shade of lipstick, and only my girls can do that.
And it pops. Look at this texture, look at this color, look at this wear, like, you know, I think there's so many domains, and we have the most robust analytical possibility for appreciation and love. And also, when you read Audre Lorde's essay, Eye to Eye, talking about hatred, like, the fact that we get so much hatred in the world, she says Black women, like, eat hatred like daily bread in the world. It's easiest for us to give that to one another. So you have all of these women who are like, understand Black women as their primary adversaries in life, or their obstacles in life, far more than like the harvest, the heaven, the richest place of love ever. And I love for people to just move into that zone. And I appreciate one by one helping many Black women land and realize, like, oh, this is the Disneyland that I can die on. This is the mountain that I can die on.
Yes. We're building promised land and ushering everyone to it. So. Okay, so we invited you on the show because last week we read this story called Four Letter Word, and it centers around the theme of sexual identity. The main character really has trouble kind of being her full lesbian self. And we know that your research focuses on like how people internalize those bullshit ass standards. Tell us a little bit about how the suppression can impact the way Black women move through the world.
That's a really, really, really good question.
It was curious.
Throw me under the bus this time.
No, that's a good ass question. I just, you know, like, I'm giving credit where it's due. I was just going to be like, where you get that duster or whatever, but you know.
It's cute too.
It's a blazer. I mean, it's got leather.
Shit. Okay.
Yeah. No, I think I can answer that from so many places. I can most recently just tell you two ways that I've studied and thought about that is we have this concept in social psychology called meta-stereotype awareness. And what that means is, I think for some people, we think about stereotypes and whether or not you believe them is what will catch you up. So like, you think about kids and you're like, somebody doesn't believe a girl can do it. And it's like, doesn't matter about them, boo. Like, you can and so you will. And then the story is in many storybooks, then you do because you believed in yourself. But meta-stereotype awareness says like, you don't even have to believe that girls perform worse. The notion that you are aware that other people think that girls perform worse means that you will inherently perform worse, right? It is a kind of combination of stereotype threat. And I started wanting to know about like, well, how does that work for women who are negotiating around this assumption for Black women always, that we're negotiating around this narrative that we're hypersexual. You got Missy Elliott saying, like, pussy don't fail me now. I got you missing. I was like, well, nobody but me. But also, we know that if you're too eager, if you look too wanton, if you look too, you know, skilled, then use a hoe, right? And that you're only good for a good time, and then you become suspect. If you have too much sexual agency or too much interest, you look suspect, right? It challenges your domains of femininity or passivity or whatever the narratives are that we have for women, particularly in heterosexuality, but also in queerness around femininity, to look agentic and interested and thirsty. You're not allowed to do that. So I think I like to understand that concept about how are we negotiating around those things, whether or not we actually internalize them, which some people do. And they're like, I can't have more than 5 sexual partners in my whole lifespan, so I can't afford this conversation, right? Like going in and dating, I learned that in college. Or when I went to grad school, because like where I'm from, we're all like thotty, and I thought that was norm. And then I went to Michigan, and there was all these undergrads, and they're like, I don't have 2 partners. I'm like, guys, because these white students are like, I bust down 5 just today. Like they had so much possibility. Yes, like literally, like face down, ass up in the streets every Saturday morning, like for a game. And I was like, why is it so different? But I think respectability really kicked in for those folks. And there was a narrative like, you can't have mileage. You can't have bodies. Like, you can't be somebody understood, because that takes you out of the eligibility for these partnerships that you really are interested in. Now, whether or not there's no figmentive, there's no wear and tear on the time. Like, it doesn't actually work like that. But cognitively it does. And so therefore, and socially there is stigma, and therefore it carries traction. So I think about, I can answer that question from a million angles, but I'm really interested in what is the harm in us holding in awareness that there is an imagining that our proximity to these golden rings of baddiness, whether that be about how we actually physiologically look, whether that be about what our level of sexual experience is, whether that be about our class, or whether or not we're mothers, or whether or not we were married when we became mothers, whether or not we are able, or if we have some ability challenges, any of those things that we're holding that might take us away from the ideal can like situate itself to diminish our sense of sexual self-esteem, the sense of self-efficacy as human beings, and sometimes even our relationship to racial identity. And like, there's a proper kind of Black. We imagine that there's a Black monolith. And if you're going to be an attractive Black woman, we have a script for that. If you're going to be just like a badass Black woman, we have a script for that. Because Fannie Lou Hamer was not, in any kind of way, Josephine Baker. And we must never get those two mixed. But like, yes, we are a multitude, and we have all of those things. So the more expansive that we can be around the narratives of exceptionalism or idealism that we internalize, the more free we are. And by free, I mean, in the way that I've been measuring that is like, some folks are not having sex, and that's a problem or not a problem for folks. But if you are having sex, how do you negotiate that? Sexual assertiveness is how I think about that, which is your capacity to initiate the sex that you want, the expectation that you deserve pleasure, the room to negotiate that event in a way that is optimizing your pleasure, and also the skill and the capacity to refuse unwanted or unsafe sex. And so if you made it through all that, which so many ladies in my surveys like don't always make it through, then how do you have this experience of sex without emerging from the event without so much guilt and shame? So many people go into a tailspin after that. So many people don't feel good enough to show up in that, right? Like, yes, body, eat it, here it is. Like, they're like, turn the lights off. Nothing jiggle, don't move, like be dead. If someone can actually show up fully for the sexual event, then feel good enough to like feel entitled to pleasure and negotiate that, then end and not be like, I'm a hoe, that was terrible, and I'm today. Like, if you can do all of that, like, you're more likely to get through that experience in a way that is pleasurable, and where only pleasure stays on the tongue and the spirit, if you're not internalizing these narratives about what it should be, or like internally idealizing these proximities, right? Like, oh, I would fuck better if I were lighter skinned, or if I were thinner, you know, or I would get a better quality of D if I looked a particular way, because as, you know, Andre 3000 says, there's a presumption that top-notch hoes get the most, not the lesser, or in UGK that I choose you. And it's like, but it, do you?
Girl, it's wild. I'm like, you are over here preaching to me. Damn, you preaching. Okay, I'm just gonna, yeah, we're gonna, once this is off, because I don't want to, bitch, you preaching, like, you legit got brought tears to my eyes. Yeah.
So, I know in some parts of your research, you kind of look at the ways that media kind of influences that development of that gendered racial identity. Can we talk about how media has us fucked up and how it contributes to us not being able to fall into that pleasure in that way?
We can. I always want to stand a little bit for, like, we'll have to, like, classify that by nature of how I study things, it's, like, primed to study the worst. Psychology studies the worst, or the absence of worst, and presumes that that's best. And that is not best. If you're not studying best, and you're not expecting to find best, you will not yield best. So I have to say that. I do try to do different kind of things methodologically to optimize the possibility for best, including having measures of literally best. And also I find worst a lot. I find in my own personal life, misogyny sounds good as fuck. And there is a way that even when you don't hear the lyrics, a repetition of the ethos or the mission still catches itself in your spirit somehow, even acts those things. So we find a lot of times where you will have, like, hip hop is the worst, like, right? When you look at the lyrics, some of the things that I've done, one of my first studies in grad school was looking at, I wanted to take whatever we're talking about in terms of, like, gendered scripts and what is positive about femininity, what's negative about masculinity. And I wanted to see how much are we actually talking about that in Black music. So I looked at 25 years of the top charting hip-hop R&B songs or songs performed by Black artists, and I wanted to see to what degree, how salient is the message that, like, they're just saying shit, like, about hoes and tricks. How is it? If it comes out 95% of the time, like it does when we talk about hip-hop, then great. But it didn't. It didn't. Men had such an expansive capacity. It did. Some of these narratives did change, but also men in music got room to be lovers. They got room to be depicted as feminine, to be depicted as saviors, to be predicted as, like, in need of romanticism and interested in that, just as much as they got depicted as, like, stigma, dangerous, risk-taking, like, I'm everything, like, I got all the money, like, all of those narratives. Also, I got researchers at the University of Michigan to, like, read Rick Ross. And we'd have to do it out loud in a meeting. And I didn't say that was my favorite, but I have to say, in my whole research career, that was probably my favorite, getting my advisor to say, like, bitch-ass niggas, like, many times, because empirical research. Oh, I still feel good about that. Anyway, she would say, like, I'm going to say ban or pan for punk-ass niggas, you know, but she wouldn't say it, and I'm like, just say it. You know, so you can say it. If you can't say it, then you shouldn't be listening. She's like, I don't listen. I only like Pharrell's Happy. Like, that's what she was listening to a lot at the time. I think she is such a happy person, so I appreciated that. But
she was listening, like, to Young Nigga Move That Dope also.
Like, why does it sound so good? It sounds good. Misogyny sounds good. So to that end, though, when you study, like, exposure or consumption of that rhetoric, you don't buy, like, it's not a one-to-one correlate. It's not like, the more you listen to Future, the more of a hoe-ass bitch you are, period. That's it. Or the more you listen to Nicki, or the more you listen to any of these things, the more of a hoe you are. It's never that. So I appreciate that my work finds that there's not that unidirectional relationship between consumption of these messages that suggest Black women are fucking bottom rung. And then they go and then understand themselves as bottom line. But, like, again, meta stereotype awareness is also, it does hamper what your negotiation process is. Knowing that somebody thinks that you're the worst, even when you don't believe that about yourself, it hampers in some kind of way how you end up acting. It takes additional energy to not, again, reify that stereotype, not do any of that. And that cognitive energy is not always like spent focusing on pleasure, focusing on fullness, and just being like, how do I feel? Like, do I want this? Like, you go into a different sort of place. So interestingly, even though we read such, like, as a world, we consume magazines less than we ever did. The magazines and the imagery, I think, on those magazines are still one of the, like, most harmful things for women to consume in terms of their ability to sort of come out of that thinking expansively about their bodies, about their partnerships, about their sort of ideas about femininity. That is still one of the, like, most harmful places. But I don't find consistently that listening to R&B hip hop is terrible. I also don't find that it's terribly empowering. It's mixed. And I don't find that watching reality TV shows, that's never borne out. Everybody's like, well, like, that's the only way you're going to be terrible. It's literally not. I've never found a significant relationship empirically between reality television or even some of these scripted series and terrible ideas that, and constraining ideas about beauty, femininity, and all of those things. So empirically, I love that. Because I'm a bitch who loves raggedy media. So, and I feel very quick to tell somebody what you ain't doing and what I ain't is none of these things, because I'm literally the baddest. Like, you couldn't even understand it because you're not ready and you haven't ever come as many times as I've come. You don't even know what it is like to sort of live in that place. But I would like to teach you if you are available tonight. We can start our training sessions.
Yes. So in the book that we read last week, the main character who we already talked about is, you know, having some trouble being her full self. She's also having a hard time setting boundaries. And that's like with platonic relationships, romantic relationships, all the relationships, she don't know how. I'm wondering, what tools do you wish that all Black women had in that area?
So I'm writing a paper right now with my graduate student, and we deal a lot with like these stereotypes about Black women, Jezebel, Mammy, like strong Black women. And one of the, and how those relate to mental health and sexual health. And one that we hadn't ever looked at, but is ending up being like a superhero, is the sapphire stereotype. So that's like the Black woman stereotype. I have always imagined that, like, that's, again, something that Black women are just so averse to holding and never want to reify that. But we also, but in that study, we found that folks who, to whatever degree, internalized higher levels of sapphire stereotype. So I'll be that, I will call that, endorse I'll be that phenomena. And who also feel that being a Black woman is of central importance to themselves, including like the welfare of Black women in general. Mm-hmm. I'm committed to that, and their well-being is of central importance to my identity. Them hoes have better sex than everybody. Them have better boundary setting, better capacity to initiate the sex that they want, better sexual desire, better reports of wellness, sexual well-being. Sapphire is coming through. So we started thinking at my lab, me and my doctoral student were just so excited about that. And we're like, well, what is it? It was like, sapphire actually isn't bad. It's that patriarchy is bad. And patriarchy says anything that is an obstacle to me being in absolute domain, I will corrupt the image of, right? And create a system that dissuades anybody from taking that up, right? We think about like feminists, like bra burning, man hating people. And literally feminists are just like, girl, you're working, you should get paid. Like, girl, like you deserve to eat and go to sleep just like everyone else, right?
And afford child care. That's all.
Yes, that's it. You deserve, if you got this level of education too, you deserve to be able to go to school just like everybody else, or at least be able to benefit off of the degrees that you have in the same way, because you had to put in the same levels of work. And in the case of Black women, we've never been exempt from work. We've been working overtime, because we were working to produce the labor body, and also we were the bodies that were producing, you know, picking cotton just with you too, but I'm pregnant and nursing and I'm out here with you too. So I think the, like, I think I would, again, I could think if I could distill it, I would want all Black women to recognize it's not the worst to just be that, because that is likely just a maligned representation that has come out of like what it means to reconcile with powerful individuals who are resilient beyond. And if you fueled that, if we just said Stacey Abrams is literally all the things and focus on the fact that Michelle Obama, whatever it is, but like killed it at Harvard Law and maybe was even a better lawyer than her own husband. Mm. If we socialize everybody to internalize that, then we would be in trouble as a society that really rests and functions on its like subjugation of Black women. So I would challenge everyone to recognize that like Batty does get you into a place where you have to, because masculinity is so harmful, toxic, and often dangerous, and because Black women's stoicism often is about like presenting to be invulnerable or superhuman, it does mark you for danger. But in the day-to-day, you might actually have more agency. In the day-to-day, you actually might get off harder if you went in like being that, rather than if you were so focused on how to not be any of the things that take you out of the running for the most.
Mm. All right.
Yeah.
So you were just talking about being superhuman, and this is not that, but I do want to know, what's your superpower?
Ooh. I think I'm a lover, like, in all the ways, truly. And I think I have a pretty, robust capacity to bring love, to like make love happen and community happen among folks who could have never imagined that community could happen in such a way. I get to do that, but I just always envisioned a possibility that wasn't there, and I'm good at manifesting possibility. And that possibility often looks like, sometimes it's like Rihanna's like work performance on that stage where it was like the party that you always wanted to be at. Sometimes it's like Little Sims's video woman, or it's like, oh, if I die, I want heaven to look like that. But really just saying there's a vision for like more. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a superpower that I'm unwilling to accept the lesser life in any kind of way. I have like an insatiable need for everything that I need, and just being able to work to go get it. I don't acquiesce well, but I do feel like I'm able to like create community and create like collaboration across difference in a way that is pretty skilled, I think. And I've been doing that since I was younger. I also think one of the things that I have that is a superpower is a little, people don't know what to expect from me. They're like, you're a cherub, but you keep saying you want to fuck me, and I don't really know what's happening. Or like, you're a Negro and you're talking about Beyonce, but somehow I really want to like run data with you. I think there's this like, maybe like to bring in, I don't know, what was that terrible show? But they have the like vampires glamour you.
Oh, True Blood.
True Blood.
God, yeah, I watched that shit. It was hate watching at the end. But
so bad, but you couldn't. God damn it, I'm so glad to see you again. God. I do think, I don't know that I'm like glamoring for manipulation's sake, but I'm glamoring the like white supremacist patriarchy sometimes to be able to get our feet in the door. Mm. And they are never then able to look at us 100% the same afterward. And I appreciate that. I feel like I'm trying to do that with my literature. I'm trying to do that with my field. And trying to do that, like, on an individual, on a meta level, you will put respect on Black women's names because we are literally everything. Mm. And if you try to check me on it, I got all the receipts that you don't have because I studied everything harder than you ever will. So then you lost.
That. Before you even fucking started.
Yeah, you lost. Trust that.
Yes. What are you reading right now?
So I'm reading many things. That's the story of my world. Rereading Jennifer Nash had this book called Black Feminism Reimagined. It's about intersectionality and kind of a rethinking on how we might be able to utilize intersectionality. And there's this author, Christina Sharp, who has this book called In the Wake. And I just think her prose is like remarkable and comes as a psychologist who knows that like nothing good for Black folks come out of psychology, I really find so many energizing theories about what wellness actually is. I think all of us can tell you what the fuck we hate. Mm. But when you say, what do you love? Like, what makes you full? Mm-hmm. Answers are thin often. Mm-hmm. It's hard for Black women to like live there. So I think always rereading Adrienne Marie Brown's like pleasure activism, thinking for like, what's a testable question here? Mm-hmm. Thinking about like, what is actually being intersectional when you're not being just like thinking about these dimensions, like how do we be richer in how we're thinking about that in science, not necessarily in theory, but how we take that up in quantitative psychology or psychological science. And then what does it mean to like be post antebellum enslavement? Like, what does it mean to be well in this context? I think Christina Sharp talks so beautifully and richly about that. I've never met her. I hope to meet her one day and also not be gay when I meet her because of how I got turned out by how she talks about that possibility. But I think so hard about what is wellness. I'm reading the fuck out of psychology about their pathological models of knowing, but also recognizing it is very hard to think about wellness. And it's only like a Toni Morrison and Maya Angelou that can really get me to like be imagining that I have to in order to be able to measure something and then offer that back to us as a strategy for how to be socialized. And I talk to these content creators who are making media imagery about us to put those storylines in so that we can begin from an early age a collective thinking about more and not less.
What's turning you on today?
I have a new girlfriend and she is so sexy and so smart and so brilliant. And she's an English professor who studies Black lit. And she's such a boss. It's very hard to outboss me, but when ladies can, then I'm like, so, like, what are you doing for forever? Are you ready for that or not? but I am a sapiosexual, so I'm very intellectually inclined, but also I'm looking at your titties while it's happening, like the two of those things. Is why Black feminism is perfect for me as a field and as like a conflict, like a physiological place. So she is turning me the fuck on and out. I'm here for it. I'm like, yes. Like, that is people generally who are giving themselves over not only to the labor of love, like, but also to the practice of love and then to the benefit of love. Like, so many activists are working hard, but they're not like working hard in the experience part and working hard in the delight part. If anything, sometimes we work so hard that we become unable to be in pleasure. We only understand that to be a disarming moment and in danger, but she is able to think very deeply and bask endlessly in the depths of pleasure. And I'm like, let's be there. Because that's what it's all about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Love that. Okay. So we always do like a lightning round, rapid kind of a situation. It's fun. And this is Erica's question. It is a very good one. And it is, please rank these couples from most trash, toxic to healthy. Knowing, of course, that this is very subjective. So I'm going to give you the couples and you rank them. So Whitley and Dwayne, Gina and Martin. Oh, you going to write them down? Yes. Okay. Gina and Martin. Melanie and Derwin. Sinclair and Overton, and Rainbow and Dre.
Heterosexual, all of them. All of them got their passes to that.
They are all heterosexual. But that also shows the fucking dearth of, like, where's everybody else on TV?
Strangely, I would say, like, Sinclair, I think they have it best. I think they probably experience more pleasure than everybody.
Mm-hmm.
They're less they're less mired down in these like notions of what should be, and then less mired down by comparing themselves to what is being approximated there and what isn't. They're in their own vision. They got their own language. They got their own land. And in that way, like, their love story, I think, is remarkable. I mean, I'm not interested. I don't personally find like quirky or like whimsy. Too much whimsy is like not, it doesn't hit.
It ain't for you.
All I got is quirk. I have no fine ass hoes that come through with all the swag. I'm like, where's that? So I feel like I'm utterly inundated in like quirk. And I am from South Central again, and I just want like be a baddie, like can like do that. There's a lot of ways to be baddie, but like we also know it when we feel it, when we see it, when we touch it. But I love, I think that couple on Living Single, we don't think enough about how their complete disregard of what should be permitted their capacity to be infinitely like capacious in how they experienced each other. Mm-hmm. You never heard Sinclair being like, Overton don't got a job doing this. Overton, he ain't doing this. He ain't. It was never. And he was never like, Sinclair, like, how come you're not running anything over there? How come you don't lose weight? Or how come da da da? Like, what, like, nothing. They never had those conversations with one another. And I think in that way, they got to be probably the most free of all of these couples.
Love that.
What are your rankings? How would you rank them?
I'm with you. I actually think that they have the healthiest relationship of them all. I just think that they're so incredibly sweet and loving. And like you said, they really weren't worried about what everybody else was doing. Like, they knew that they were for each other, and they made that shit happen. And it was always all love, no matter what else was going on around them.
Okay.
Yeah, for sure. Erica is also saying me too. Yes. Okay, so what's next for you? What are you working on?
Well, I am working on a million things. I'm working on queering Black body image. So I've thought a lot about how these approximations of white beauty norms happen for Black women, and how like femininity can fuck you up in the game, even when you are close to it, close to the ideal. Again, back to that question, like, if you're the closest to a 10, do you win? And my surveys say no, not necessarily. If you have this doubt, like, what is your attitude? And what are your beliefs? And those sometimes have more bearing on what your outcomes are. But I didn't get to think about that among a gender expansive group. And I didn't think about that among Black women who aren't necessarily trying to bag a cishet dude, to think like, well, how does body image actually work there? And how does the strong Black woman work for folks who are non-binary or maybe mask presenting or who don't buy into femininity in the same way? I just want to know, like, does body image like serve as a precursor to not only mental health, but also sexual health, in the same way that we find for heterosexual Black women? So that's one project that I'm working on. I'm working on another project that is thinking through how in the field do we measure whether or not your media was impactful. And I wanna learn that to be able to see like what is the opportunity to utilize media, digital media and television media, as an intervention on Black femininity socialization. Like, if we can socialize, I don't know if it's going to be the Sinclair James phenomena, but certainly more Sinclair James than it would be Regine, in terms of how to be in the world. Sinclair was happy, hella happy. People talked about that as just a personality characteristic, but it also, I think, was about how she negotiated her world. But if you could write that in, is that an intervention? I know that you're not going to get conversations on wellness from school. You might not get them from your parents or at home or even in the Kiki sessions with our homegirls. You might not get that, but we do need to learn that Sapphire can be a superhero strength of ours if we just stop fighting it. We can learn any of the topics of any of my papers recently, and it might be that we have to talk about it in a larger landscape where people are watching these media. We're in a moment where, like, you got your Issa, you got your Ava, you got your own, you got everybody who's, like, on these Netflix shows are so hungry for content that's culturally targeted. But if you're not saying the right message, then you're just going to reify the same like domination that we've got here. So I'm doing work that might be more impactful. I'm asking questions that I think might be useful to content creators so that like rather than studying an intervention like funded by the National Institutes of Health, Oprah will just take me up, fund me, and then we can just work together to like figure out how to get Black women another idea about how to be, how to get off in all the ways, but certainly how to have more and aspire to more. Well,
yay. That's all very exciting. I want to know, for folks who want to follow you, know more about your work, keep up with what you're doing, where can they find you online?
You can find me on Twitter. I do not post very much. But Dr_Niecie, NEECIE, you will find me, Dr_Niecie. And then you can always email me. You can find me at psych at UVA Virginia. My email address is la4gd@virginia.edu. If you want to know any of these exciting findings and learn more about what you might be able to do to get off more fully, or if you're just trying to help, like, let me know. I'd love to find you in these streets and make more friends and make more collaborators who are trying to make interventions on public health, who are trying to do theoretical interventions on the field, folks who are writing books, anybody who's doing work on Black women's freedom and trying to figure out different kind of place for them or reproductive justice. Like, I want to be in community and conversation with you. So please, I invite you to find me so that we can have some pretty live discussions.
Yay. Okay. Y'all do that. And like, for real, thank you so much for coming on, Lanise.
Thank you so much for having me.
This was lovely. Yay. And that is it for this week's episode of the show. Thank y'all for listening, and we'll see you next week. Bye. This episode was produced by us, Kenry and Erica, and edited by Ballistic. The theme music is from Brazy. Hit subscribe right now in your favorite podcast app and at youtube.com/theturnonpodcast so you'll never miss an episode.
Then follow us on Twitter at The Turn On Pod and Instagram at The Turn On Podcast. And you can find links to books, transcripts, guest info, what's turning us on, and other fun stuff at theturnonpodcast.com.
And don't forget to email us at theturnonpodcast@gmail.com with your book recommendations and your pressing sex and related questions.
And you can support the show by leaving us a 5-star review, buying some merch, or becoming a patron of the show. Just head to theturnonpodcast.com to make that happen.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon. Holla.